Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Once the sun slipped down below the dry hills to the west and the heat of the day began to slip away, the desert evening's cold arrived, hard-edged and biting. The women and men leading the train of loaded-down oxen pushed on down the dry watercourse. They shivered, pulling their cowhide garments close around them to ward off the cold as the wind whipped through the dusty valley. "Just a bit further," said the woman at the head of the oxen. There was a green oasis around that next bend, a place where the water still bubbled up to the surface in this arid landscape. They could stop for the night, make sure the oxen were foddered and watered, build a fire to ward off the cold. One more day of traveling would carry them out of the desert and back to the great river valley at the heart of their world. The oxen bellowed and protested, plodding wearily along the rocky pathway. Unlike the human travelers, they didn't know that the end of their day's labors was at hand. Then again, the human travelers weren't loaded down with gifts and trade goods sent south from the kings at Abydos to the neighboring kings who ruled the lands around the first cataract of the Nile. Fine decorated pottery, pungent incense, and a beautifully carved stone macehead, among other things, were the bread and butter of the trade that tied together the entirety of the Nile Valley around 3200 BC. Gold from the desert sources went north, and the products of the society that would soon become Egypt went in the other direction, toward the country they called the Land of the Bow. One of the travelers, armed to prevent an attempt at thievery, propped his bow against one of the trees that sprouted at the edge of the water. He rubbed an aching leg, careful not to wipe off the elaborate pattern of white body paint that decorated his skin. The woman who had led the caravan to the oasis knelt down and cupped her hands together to take a drink. The water splashed onto the red paint streaked across her face, and a droplet hung for a moment from the stone plug that pierced her bottom lip. All of them collapsed onto the ground as soon as they'd seen to their oxen, exhausted after weeks of traversing the dried-out waterways of the desert on the journey from Abydos to the first of the rocky rapids that broke the great river's course. One more day, and then they would be back to the Nile, ready to present their king with the wealth of the north. More than 5,000 years ago, Egypt was on the cusp of becoming the civilization we're familiar with. But there's another story, one that revolves around the land to the south, with which we're not as familiar. In what's now southern Egypt and northern Sudan, a whole series of sophisticated and long-lived societies made their home. They interacted with ancient Egypt, of course, but they were also the conduit that tied Africa together, the point where the Sahara, the Ethiopian highlands, and sub-Saharan Africa all converged on the mighty Nile. Today, let's explore this land, one better known as Nubia. And also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I read, naturally, from your distributor of choice. If you've ever been looking for a way to support Tides of History, ordering The Verge is the best way you could do it, and I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. When we think about the distant past, our attention tends to settle on just a few times and places. Rome, Greece, Egypt, Mesopotamia, maybe Göbekli Tepe, or the cave art of the Upper Paleolithic. These are the major stopping points on the short and incomplete tour of humanity's history that we usually get, if we're even lucky enough to be exposed to that much. But there's a lot more out there than just those times and places that first jump to our attention. While some foragers were hauling limestone pillars into place at Göbekli Tepe, others were hunting mammoth in North America or gathering shellfish along the coast of Japan. There were other societies in the ancient Mediterranean when the Greeks set off on their missions of trade and colonization. The people of the steppe were engaged in their own massive expansion across Eurasia at the same time that folks in Mesopotamia were building their first cities and states. When we let the familiar, or at least the more familiar, stand in for an entire era, we miss the foundational diversity that defines our collective past. People do lots of different stuff, and we should strive to understand that range. The cultures that exist alongside the ones we think we know well often suffer the most because of this dynamic. The spotlight of modern attention shines on Mesopotamia, and our eyes are blind to the Elamites and the people of the Kura-Araxes culture, who lived to the north and east. And when modern attention does fall on these neighboring people, they're too often judged by the standards of their better-known neighbors, using terms and analytical frameworks and value judgments developed from much different societies. Nowhere has suffered more from these tendencies than the land lying to the south of Egypt along the Nile River, what's traditionally been known as Nubia or Kush. Today, it lies mostly in the modern nation of Sudan. For more than 200 years, Egypt's monumental architecture, rich tombs, and vast written record, all of them spanning thousands upon thousands of years, have dominated the attention of both archaeologists and the general public. Nubia has been either ignored completely or, more often, interpreted in light of its relationship to what was happening further to the north. As a source of trade goods, as a target for conquest, and as a passive recipient of ancient Egypt's glorious culture. This way of looking at things, as you might expect, at best obscures the nature of Nubia's relationship with Egypt by essentially assuming that all the influence and power ran from north to south. Influence and power are always, always a two-way street. Far more important, this misses developments within Nubia itself and Nubia's own connections to the deserts on either side of the Nile Valley, to the Ethiopian highlands to the east, and to sub-Saharan Africa to the south. Nubia was a dynamic place for thousands upon thousands of years. It was packed full of long-lived cultures that were intimately connected not only to ancient Egypt, but also to a whole variety of other societies. The first complex societies in Inner Africa developed in Nubia. The way of life that eventually produced pharaonic civilization and what became Egypt moved north from the south, from Nubia. Nubia produced state structures of its own, states that looked much different than their Egyptian neighbors to the north. One of these states eventually conquered Egypt in the 8th century BC, ruling as the 25th dynasty. A huge amount of archaeological work has been done in Sudan over the last couple of decades, and we now have absolute mounds of evidence spanning thousands of years, evidence that offers us whole new narratives of Nubia's history. We can reevaluate Nubia's relationship with Egypt, but we can also understand the societies there on their own terms, not just as a reflection of their powerful neighbor to the north. Today, we'll explore this exciting new work and what it can tell us about an enormous and often neglected region of Africa. So, a couple of notes before we get started today. I'm relying heavily on two extremely recent books. The first is the Oxford Handbook of Ancient Nubia, especially the chapters by Maria Carmela Gatto, Matthew Honegger, and Bruce Beyer Williams, and Elena A.A. Garcia's Prehistory of the Sudan. These are dense but really excellent resources if you'd like to learn more. So, how do we define Nubia? In broad terms, we're talking about what's often called the Middle Nile, or sometimes the Cataract Nile. From Aswan in the south to the Nile Delta in the north, where it meets the Mediterranean, the Nile is a broad, unbroken, and navigable stretch of water. This is the Lower Nile, and for most of the past 5,000 or so years, it's been the heartland of Egypt. From Aswan to Khartoum in the south, however, the river is broken by a series of rapids, places where the river is shallow and full of big boulders, little stones, and rocky little islets. These are the cataracts, and there are six of them in total. The first cataract, where the Aswan Dam currently sits, is in Egypt. The other five are in what's today Sudan. The area between the first and second cataracts has traditionally been kind of a boundary zone between Egypt and Nubia, going back and forth between the two. But south of the second cataract, you're pretty indisputably in Nubia. The Middle Nile is a really, really big region. As the crow flies, it's about 600 miles, 1,000 kilometers, from Aswan to Khartoum. That's further than the distance from Aswan to the Mediterranean. And because of the way the Nile loops and bends through Sudan, the actual distance is even greater. It's about 1,100 miles, 1,780 kilometers. It's not just the Nile River Valley, either. Nubia stretches out in both directions on either side, west into the Libyan desert and east toward the Red Sea and the Ethiopian plateau. The southern end of traditional Nubia lies at the city of Khartoum, That's where the Nile's two main tributaries, the White Nile flowing up from the south and the Blue Nile winding its way down from the Ethiopian highlands in the east, meet. In essence, the land we call Nubia sits at the intersection of several of Africa's key environments, from desert to mountainous highlands to river floodplain to savanna to the fringes of the tropical forest. Each of those environments is a potential conduit, at times something like a highway, for ideas, trade goods, and especially people. People have inhabited the Middle Nile, the region that eventually became Nubia, for a very, very long time. Evidence of human occupation stretches back to at least 600,000 years ago. Of course, these wouldn't have been anatomically modern humans, probably something more like Homo heidelbergensis, the species that was probably the common ancestor of Neanderthals, maybe Denisovans, and modern humans. The earliest direct evidence of modern humans is about 300,000 years old, from the site of Jebel Ikhoud in what's now Morocco. There were also stone tools found at that site along with the human remains, and these tools resemble tools of a similar age found along the Middle Nile. The logical inference is that the Middle Nile was one of the earliest homelands of Homo sapiens, at least for a while. I say for a while because periods of human occupation along the Middle Nile ebbed and flowed as the environment shifted from 300,000 years ago onward, along with the climatic conditions. It oscillated between hotter and cooler, and especially between wetter and drier. During humid periods, much of what's now the Sahara became green corridors filled with lakes, rivers, and a lush savanna biome with all the wildlife that went along with that. People could follow those green corridors into the Nile Valley and beyond, through the Sinai and into Arabia, which was also much greener and more welcoming than it is today. At other times, the Sahara expanded. It became even larger and more hostile than it is now, if you can imagine that. It effectively became a barrier to human movement, and it made the Nile Valley a much less attractive place to live. These cycles came and went over tens of thousands of years, and human occupation in Nubia mirrored the climatic oscillations pretty closely. Around the last glacial maximum, about 20,000 years ago, the Sahara was in one of these hyper-arid phases. The desert stretched about 300 miles, 500 kilometers, to the south of its current edges. One of the Nile's major tributaries, the White Nile, which flows up from the south, almost completely dried up into a seasonal trickle. The Blue Nile and the Atbara, the other two tributaries which rise in the Ethiopian highlands, were inconsistent at best. Life in the region was essentially restricted to the Nile Valley itself, since the desert oases had likewise dried up during this prolonged arid period. This wouldn't have been an easy place to make a living. The river alternated between a bare, dying trickle in the spring and a raging torrent in late summer. At that point, only a tiny sliver of the Nile Valley would have been free of floodwaters. The only animals that lived there in any numbers were aurochs, wild cattle, hartebeest, and the Dorcas gazelle, along with much smaller numbers of hippopotamus and wild ass. The people who lived there, as you might expect, put a heavy emphasis on fishing and gathering the seasonally available plants that grew along the riverbanks. There wasn't much space. As a result, the various groups living in the valley seemed to have fought each other regularly. The cemetery of Jebel Sahaba on the border of present-day Sudan and Egypt dates to between 13,000 and 14,000 years ago. It was absolutely full of people of all ages, from children to the elderly, who had suffered violent deaths. 11% of the people buried in the cemetery had perifractures, broken forearms from trying to ward off a blow. Of the 61 sets of remains, 21 of them had stone projectile points associated with them, meaning they'd been shot with arrows. Others had cut marks on the bones, fractures that occurred at the time of death, and a variety of healed injuries. Some scholars have argued that the Jebel Sahaba Cemetery is the world's oldest evidence of intensive, long-term intergroup conflict, in other words, war, in human history. If that's the case, it seems likely that the environmental pressure of living in a place that was crowded with people and which only provided limited resources was the cause. But environments are always shifting. They're not a constant. As the Holocene dawned and the climate began to shift once more after about 11,500 years ago, quite suddenly the Nile Valley and its environs became a much more welcoming place to live. The Sahara entered one of its much wetter phases, the most recent of these so-called Green Sahara episodes. The reasons for this are complicated, but it basically boils down to the fact that a belt of rainfall that had previously fallen further to the south across Central Africa moved north. The area around Khartoum, for example, received about 3 times as much rainfall as it does currently. Lakes filled low-lying depressions in what's now the hyper-arid desert of Sudan, Chad, and Libya. Long-dead drainage channels, what are now called wadis, reactivated. They became seasonal, if not perennial, rivers. The people crowded along the Nile could simply follow these newly viable routes out into the desert, where they colonized a new savanna environment that was stocked with wild game like giraffes and elephants. The Nile Valley, stretching from Khartoum in the south to Egypt in the north, became the heartland of a much broader region rather than an isolated refuge. The environment, including temperature, rainfall, and flood regimes, continued to shift over the course of the Holocene, but it stayed much wetter and more viable for a long time. The Nile had a ton of seasonal tributaries and multiple braided river channels along much of its length. This provided a huge array of different environments in which people could live. Hunter-gatherers built permanent or semi-permanent homes along the riverbanks. They caught fish, they hunted hippopotamus and aurochs, and they gathered plants. These foragers made a distinctive kind of pottery covered in wavy lines and wave-like patterns of incised dots. And they weren't isolated from what was happening elsewhere. Sometime around 8,000 years ago, around 6,000 BC, domesticated animals were introduced to the Nile Valley from West Asia. They were probably adopted by the existing groups of foragers rather than being evidence of a new population movement into the region. The hunter-gatherers who had hunted, fished, and made their pottery along the river simply started raising some cattle and goats to go along with their more traditional fare. Over time, however, the introduction of domesticated animals would transform the entire Nile Valley, laying the foundations for a much different world. Mobile pastoralism, with herders moving their cattle from site to site in the valley and the viable desert beyond over the course of the year, became an enduring way of life.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
As I mentioned earlier, there's been a strong tendency to view Egypt and Nubia as separate things, and to see the influence running solely from the supposedly more sophisticated north to the less developed south. There's no period for which this is more damaging to our understanding of past reality, and more completely untrue, than for the time just before the rise of the pharaohs in Egypt. Just before 5000 BC, a shared way of life took hold throughout the Nile Valley, from Khartoum in the south all the way to the edge of the Nile Delta in the north. The era of the Green Sahara was coming to an end. The patterns of rainfall were drifting further back to the south. Lakes and rivers dried up. Permanent settlements out in the desert were no longer viable, so many of the people who'd made their homes at oases or along the now drained rivers made their way into the Nile Valley proper. As they moved, they brought their way of life into the Nile Valley with them. That's not to say that there weren't different ethnic groups, or that they all had exactly the same practices, or that they spoke the same languages, but that there were essential similarities uniting the people who lived throughout the whole Nile Valley. The greatest similarity was their mode of subsistence, mobile pastoralism. Domesticated animals had been introduced to the Nile Valley around 6000 BC, with crops following maybe 500 years after that, but livestock took hold far more deeply than wheat and the like. Rather than settling down into permanent villages and cultivating crops, the people of the Nile Valley went on the move. They took their herds with them from grazing site to grazing site, both along the river and out into the still viable parts of the desert. Since these people were regularly on the move, they placed a great deal of emphasis on the body. They decorated themselves with body paint and probably tattoos, and styled their hair in ways that spoke to their individual and group identities. Only their cemeteries were permanent, communities of the dead rather than villages of the living. That's what gave these groups a claim to ancestral rights over the landscape. What's really striking about this way of life is that it seems to show up earlier in what's now Sudan rather than Egypt. In other words, it took hold from south to north rather than vice versa. This makes sense, right? Why would people 7,000 or 8,000 years ago see the first cataract of the Nile as the edge of their world? The Nile Valley beyond was every bit as habitable to them as what they knew further south. Why not just keep going? And that's exactly what they did. They created a way of life based around cattle herding, the body, and the centrality of death. And this united the entire Nile Valley in some shared characteristics that persisted for a couple thousand years. Eventually, of course, farming did take hold in what became Egypt. So did permanent settlements. Eventually, state power emerged in the form of the pharaohs. But the background to those later developments, the ones with which we're so familiar, was this foundational pastoral culture. Some of the most prominent aspects of life in ancient Egypt, from the death rituals to the importance of cemeteries to elaborate practices of body decoration, had their roots deep in this shared pastoral past. The divergence between what became Egypt and what became Nubia happened in stages over the course of the 4th millennium BC. Permanent villages and farming became more prominent in Egypt by about 3800 BC, and the process accelerated even more after around 3300 BC, with the beginning of what's called the Nakata III, or pre-dynastic period in Egyptian prehistory. This was when the earliest identifiable kings began to emerge in Upper Egypt, especially at a place called Abydos. They built massive tombs for themselves, they pioneered hieroglyphic writing, and they fought with other small-time rulers who resided at places like Hierakonpolis. Eventually, this process of fighting and consolidation produced the first known dynasties in Egyptian history, what we call Dynasty Zero and the First Dynasty. After conquering or otherwise absorbing the Nile Delta, Lower Egypt, sometime between 3100 and 3000 BC, particularly the king known as Narmer, we can talk about the beginning of the early dynastic period and the emergence of what we think of as Egypt. Most discussions of the dawn of an identifiable Egypt focus on the relationship between Upper and Lower Egypt, between the Nile Valley and the Delta. Maybe they go a bit further, and they point to the obvious connections between Egypt and the emerging states of Mesopotamia, like Uruk. That's unavoidable when we want to talk about the birth of the state and written language. At the same time, however, it's not like the Nile Valley north of the cataracts stopped being connected to the Nile Valley further south. Routes along the river and through the desert remained open. Trade goods, ideas, and especially people continued to move between them. Elements of what we call Nakata material culture, like pottery, went south along the Nile deep into what later became Nubia. At the same time, objects more commonly found in Nubia also showed up on Nakata sites in Upper Egypt. Not as many items as went south, but their presence is still notable. So rather than a strict division between worlds, we can see continuous interactions moving both south and north along the Nile and out into the surrounding deserts. At the site of Bir Sahara in the western desert, due west of Abu Simbel, archaeologists found both Nubian pottery and the typical Nakata wares. The site was probably a stopover on the desert trade routes connecting Nubia to the oases further north. In fact, the whole area around the first cataract, near what's now Aswan, was very much a hybrid zone between these two worlds, combining aspects of Nubian and Nakata cultural traditions. At the same time as the dim outlines of an Egyptian state were coming into view at places like Abydos, a very different process of state formation was taking place to the south, especially where I was talking about around the first cataract of the Nile. This process was intertwined with what was happening in Egypt to the north, which we'll talk about, but it was also very much its own thing, with its own trajectory and its own afterlife. The Nubian A Group, as it's known, was the first state-level society in Inner Africa, and it left a long legacy for the later states of Nubia and beyond. A Group isn't as imposing a name as pre-dynastic, the term we give to the early stages of state formation in Upper Egypt. Hindsight is literally baked into pre-dynastic. Pre-dynastic tells us that dynastic is coming next, an inevitable forward march to the Egypt we know about, and at the same time, it tells us that key elements of that future must already have been in place. A Group doesn't carry that sense of foreshadowing. It's sterile, a placeholder of a name. But if we were traipsing along the desert routes leading outward from the Nile Valley or taking a reed boat up or downstream around 3300 BC, how would we know where the future lay? At that specific moment, when the precocious kings at Abydos were building their mud brick tombs and making war on their neighbors, the elites living further to the south around the First Cataract were building their own system of power. For an elite group to rule, it needs to somehow convince people that it deserves to be in charge. This is the ideology of rulership, the system of symbols and beliefs that legitimize an elite group without them having to constantly brutalize their lessers to remind them where power actually resides. That's what those elaborate royal tombs and icons and claims to divine adjacency were all about with the kings of Abydos. The elite of the A Group were doing different things. They had to because the people that they wanted to rule weren't the sedentary villagers of the Upper Nile, but semi-nomadic pastoralists and traders moving along the desert wadis and narrow, rocky confines of the Cataract Nile. Power had to work differently there. It was more diffuse and mobile. It was more based on broad networks and the distribution of authority, even if it could draw some inspiration from the new kings further north. None of this is to say that Nubian society, like Egyptian society, wasn't growing more complex or hierarchical, more ruled by its elite, just that this was happening in different ways. There is no single path to social complexity and state formation. You don't have to pass through a set series of stages, like villages to towns to cities to an overarching state. Institutionalizing power can take many different forms. We can see this A Group elite's power in a whole bunch of different facets. Where people lived within Nubia seems to have shifted. More of them moved north. They clustered around the First Cataract of the Nile, the heartland of the A Group's rulers. Their cemeteries show clear and obvious evidence of social inequality. At the site of Kustul, the tombs themselves were monumental, with large shafts leading to a chamber with a funerary bed for the deceased. Multiple people, including adult men and women and children, all the way down to infants, were placed together in these graves, along with a really rich assortment of burial goods. Large jars from Egypt were particularly popular, and fine, eggshell-thin, highly decorated pots were imported from as far away as Palestine, just to be placed in these graves. Lip plugs, stone vessels, seals, and mace heads of the kind popular to the north in Egypt were all popular grave goods as well. One of the most prominent and unique objects found in these elite graves were large numbers of elaborate incense burners. These were commonly used in religious rituals, and especially for funerals. This new elite also seems to have built permanent settlements, particularly in the strategic places controlling access to the trade routes, running out into the desert, and at the narrowest, rockiest points along the Nile. If you wanted to move people or goods from the Sahara, the Ethiopian highlands, or sub-Saharan Africa toward Egypt and then the Near East beyond, well, you had to work through the elites of the Nubian A Group. They were, in essence, a trading elite. They were influencing and influenced by all of the regions to which they were adjacent. This A Group elite developed in conjunction with the elite of the Nakata culture to the north. I mentioned decorated stone maces a moment ago. These were common symbols of power among the new kings of Abydos. One of the most famous carved stone mace heads dates to the reign of Narmer, and they also show up in the graves of Nubian elites. Some of them, in fact, were made in Egypt, probably at a royal workshop, and reached the lands around the cataracts as gifts from the kings of Abydos to their southern counterparts. The A Group elite's language of power was heavily influenced by Egypt. A seal impression found at Siali, south of the First Cataract, depicts a man seated on a throne looking toward a serek. That's a symbol for a palace facade, with a falcon, the symbol of royalty, above it. The serek is a stereotypical Egyptian symbol of royalty, and that was one of several images of royal power that made their way to the A group. Others included the distinctive white crown of Upper Egypt. But there were also uniquely Nubian aspects to this visual language of authority, including cattle, central to a society still mostly built on herding, and those incense burners, which have no parallels, and they must have been central to religious and funeral rituals. Nubia itself was represented with the image of a bow. The archaic Egyptian name for Nubia was Taseti, the land of the bow, and perhaps this was what the would-be king depicted in the seal believed he ruled. The most likely scenario is that the kings of Abydos and the rulers of the Nubian A group societies built and shared a monopoly on long-distance trade, and that this was the source of the A group's wealth and power. Precisely what they traded is unclear, but it seems pretty certain that the A group was involved in the mining and transport of gold from the desert to Egypt. Whatever it was, this was enough wealth to produce a distributed form of power. Even if there was a king at the top, power was still more diffuse than in Egypt, and not even necessarily focused around a single male lineage. We can tell that since the elite graves also contained children, and especially women in prominent positions. In fact, some archaeologists believe that women were so prominent in these elite graves that their social and political role was greater than the men, which is a fascinating possibility. Beyond that, more than one elite cemetery was in use at any given time in this period. There was one at Kustul and two in the Sayala area between the first and the second cataracts, so this elite must have been a fairly broad group at the top of society. A king may have sat at the pinnacle of the A group, but a trading elite dispersed over a significant area controlled a series of routes connecting pre-dynastic Egypt to the wider world. This was a complex society and at the very least a proto-state, even if it was built on much different foundations than the Egyptians to the north, with whom they shared so much.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
The last phases of the A group, developing in parallel with the rising power of the pharaohs at Abydos, were the richest and strongest. The people living around the first cataract of the Nile, at the southern border of what's today Egypt, did a bit of farming, but they were mostly traders and cattle herders. Even their imposing settlements, the ones overlooking the key choke points on the overland and river trade routes connecting Egypt to Nubia, could be and probably were abandoned when there was no trading to be done and the livestock needed to graze elsewhere. But by around 3000 BC, the A group quite suddenly came to an end. It dropped off to such an extent that we can call it a genuine collapse. The climate took a turn for the worse. It dried out the desert pastures that had provided additional essential grazing for the A group's herds and flocks. But a more important factor was probably what was happening to the north right around then. The pre-dynastic stage of Egyptian history gave way to the early dynastic and the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt. The kings of Abydos were now rulers of the whole country. They were the pharaohs of the first dynasty, and they had ambitions to match. It cannot have been lost on them that their neighbors to the south were powerful and wealthy thanks to their control of the trade routes that converged around the first cataract of the Nile. With their growing might, this incipient state that they'd built, why not take that for themselves? Why deal with a Nubian elite when you could control those routes outright? The precise sequence of events is pretty unclear, but the overall effect was obvious. The A group, with its distinctive elite burials and wide-ranging way of life, disappeared from its heartland around the first cataract. In its place, the region came much more strongly under the rule of the kings to the north. Instead of a hybrid zone, this essentially became part of Egypt. The people of the A group, who had made their homes there for centuries, were forced to move out. Some may have been forcibly deported, others left of their own accord. Some stuck around, though. They simply became even more mobile than they'd already been. They used the desert even more extensively than they had before, without the seasonal and permanent settlements they'd previously occupied around the river. a cemetery near Luxor and whole complexes of graves, enclosures, and standing stones out in the eastern desert mark a few of the new homes of the A group. Some made their way into the hilly country beyond the eastern desert on the fringes of the Red Sea. Still others went south, some of them a long way south, as far as the fourth cataract of the Nile deep in what's today Sudan. There, they buried their dead as their predecessors at the first cataract had done, complete with imported shells from the Red Sea. Not all of the people who had lived around the first cataract under the umbrella of the A group went quite so far south. Upper Nubia, the region stretching along the Nile after the second cataract, already had inhabitants. It had for quite some time, and they shared much in common with their neighbors to the north. The A group overlaps chronologically with these residents of Upper Nubia. Around 3000 BC, they belonged to what's known as the Pre-Kerma culture. The Pre-Kerma culture, like the people of the A group, relied on cattle and supplemented their livestock with some barley and wheat. But, so far as we know, they were less focused on cemeteries and death rituals than their neighbors to the north. We know them better through their large settlements, some of them approaching the size of true cities that must have served as the home base for a powerful elite. Nor were the Pre-Kerma folks the only people living in what's now Sudan. Other groups made their home in the deserts of western Sudan, where there was still groundwater and seasonal rivers to provide pasturage for their livestock. These were mobile herders. They traveled from spot to spot in search of prime grazing land. They seem to have migrated east into Sudan from what's now Chad, following the then-flowing rivers and rich lakes of the Green Sahara west to Wadi Hawar, the Yellow Nile, which is a now-extinct tributary of the river. Still others lived to the east of the Nile, along the Atbara River, the last of the Nile's tributaries, which leads from the Fifth Cataract southeast into the Ethiopian highlands. These people, by contrast, weren't herders. They lived in permanent, nucleated settlements that were quite large, 8 to 10 hectares in size. They cultivated the grass crop sorghum, and in fact may have been the first farmers who domesticated it. These cultural traditions south of the A group varied widely in terms of their mode of subsistence and presumably in their linguistic and cultural practices. But they also shared some common characteristics. Their pottery traditions tended to overlap, which shows influence and contact in multiple directions. Mobile livestock herders occupied pretty much all of the spaces in between settlements all across Sudan. More in some places, like the desert fringes, and fewer in others. But the most important shared facet was the fact that all of these archaeological cultures were socially complex, in the sense that different settlements had different purposes, crafts were specialized, so different people did things like making pottery or smelting metal, and there were obvious signs of social hierarchy, with some people having more than others. Whether we're talking about nomadic herders in the Saharan hinterlands of western Sudan, or specialized sorghum growers on the fringes of the Ethiopian highlands, all of them were creating their own sophisticated local and regional worlds. Even more than that, they were doing so on their own terms. They weren't in the shadow or under the influence of pre- and early dynastic Egypt, like the A group had been. We do see some Egyptian imports on these archaeological sites, especially among the pre-Kerma culture in the north, but there was nothing like the pervasive back-and-forth trading that we saw with the A group. These different cultural traditions led in a variety of future directions. The sorghum growers along the Atbara River, known as the Butana and Gash groups, became the cultural backbone of the Eritrean and Ethiopian lowlands, and then later the highlands. When the Egyptians organized large-scale, long-distance expeditions down the Red Sea to what they called the Land of Punt in search of exotic luxury goods, they were probably dealing with the descendants of these people. The herders of western Sudan seem to have disappeared. They were replaced later by another group probably more closely related to the folks living along the Nile, south of the Second Cataract. And this last group, the Pre-Kerma culture, became the basis for a powerful Nubian state, one that existed on equal terms with the Egyptians to the north for 1,000 years. This state, which we call the Kingdom of Kerma, emerged around 2500 BC. There was no sharp break with the pre-Kerma culture that preceded it in material terms. The city of Kerma, at the heart of this new state, was built right next to an extensive pre-Kerma site along the main course of the Nile. From the very beginning, Kerma seems to have been a planned and fortified settlement. It had defensive walls and bastions surrounding the residential areas. It had humble mud huts and monumental mud brick buildings, probably temples and palaces. It later added royal tombs and a port along the Nile a short distance away. less than a kilometer away, was another fortified site called Dokigel, this one enclosing large monumental buildings of mud brick, presumably still more temples and palaces of some kind. Kerma Cemetery was enormous. It had more than 40,000 burials spanning a full millennium, and many of them are quite rich. The only possible conclusion to draw here is that Dokigel and Kerma were at the heart of an extensive and presumably quite powerful state. It must have extended north toward Egypt, east and west into the deserts, and then further upstream along the Nile past the neighboring cataracts. So why then and why there? Well, there are two ways of looking at this. The first is to point to the obvious fact that Egyptian records tell us of an absolutely devastating southward expedition carried out by the pharaoh Sneferu. Sneferu was the founder of the fourth dynasty of Egypt's Old Kingdom. The fourth dynasty, as a reminder, was the one in which the largest and best-known pyramids were built by Khufu and Khafre. An Egyptian inscription records that Sneferu's army went south by boat. They captured thousands of prisoners and many more thousands, head of cattle, sheep, and goats, all of which they dragged back to Egypt with them. In response to this Egyptian pressure, the argument goes that people living in Nubia came together to create a powerful state of their own, centered on this newly built city of Kerma. On the other hand, however, maybe the Egyptians came south in response to the growth of this new state centered on Kerma, seeking to head it off before it could become a major threat. We don't know for sure. What is certain is that Kerma grew out of what was already present on the site, but that it also incorporated influences from a huge area. The unique buildings at Dokigel, for example, have parallels much further to the south in Central Africa. And we know that Kerma became the heart of a growing state, one that at least began as some kind of federation incorporating groups of much different ethnic backgrounds from all over Sudan and beyond. That state included settled agriculturalists who farmed from permanent villages, but also very large numbers of nomadic and semi-nomadic cattle herders who moved between the Nile Valley and the desert. The people living in the north, around the first and second cataracts of the Nile, belonged to an entirely different cultural tradition and presumably ethnic group. They're known as the Nubian Sea Group, and while they're separate, they still interacted closely with Kerma to the south. The fact that this state's rulers, based at Kerma, were able to exercise their power over such a large area and such a diverse group of subjects is pretty fascinating. Even if their state came into being in the first place as a result of Egyptian military pressure, it wasn't a shadow of its northern neighbor. Instead, it was built on indigenous traditions, not one but several of them, and it must have functioned much differently. The Kingdom of Kerma held up along the borders of Egypt for a full 1,000 years. From 2500 BC to 1500 BC. Nubian soldiers served in Egyptian armies in large numbers. The Theban kings, who emerged victorious from the first intermediate period and founded the Middle Kingdom, relied on Nubian mercenaries from the Sea Group, or Kerma, many of whom permanently settled in Egypt afterward. One would-be pharaoh during the first intermediate period attempted to extend his rule northward from Lower Nubia, which prompted a revenge expedition from Thebes that inflicted huge devastation. During the Middle Kingdom, a series of Egyptian kings launched major expeditions to the south. Senusret I built a string of forts to protect the border around 1950 BC. A century later, around 1850 BC, Senusret III tried and failed to conquer Kerma and settled for building a much larger chain of imposing fortresses. Senusret III's reason for doing this is couched in language that denigrates the people of Kerma, but it's telling. They seem to have launched a major attack north into Egyptian territory, and then retreated while harassing Senusret's pursuing army. The only solution for Senusret was to expend enormous amounts of resources to build fortresses to keep them out. This seems to have worked, but at a huge cost. Later, during the second intermediate period, a full-blown empire rose on the foundations built at Kerma. This was the first empire of Kush, or Old Kush, and its power extended all the way from the fourth cataract of the Nile to Elephantine in Upper Egypt. There are even signs of its influence as far away as the Horn of Africa in present-day Ethiopia and Somalia. For a while, around 1600 BC, Kush was the largest state in Africa. There's a tendency to see the power of Egypt and first Kerma, later Kush, as rising and falling in tandem. When Egypt was strong, Kush must have been weak. When Egypt was weak, during the first and second intermediate periods, that's when Kush was strongest. That's a simplistic view for a couple of reasons. Sometimes power comes at someone else's cost, sure, but sometimes it spurs rivals onwards, too. It can't be a coincidence that some of the strongest rulers of Egypt's Middle Kingdom were forced to expend tremendous amounts of effort fighting their neighbors to the south. That doesn't sound like weakness to me. Until the New Kingdom, around 1480 BC, the Egyptians never succeeded in a campaign of conquest despite multiple serious attempts. Egyptian armies were full of soldiers who hailed from the lands upstream of the First Cataract. The Land of the Bow wasn't just a romantic name, but a description of the useful skills of its inhabitants. Even after the Egyptian conquest during the New Kingdom, Kush didn't disappear. Its kings later conquered Egypt itself, they built pyramids of their own, and they briefly competed in the great power competitions with the states of the Near East. But beyond the failure of a zero-sum back and forth between Nubia and Egypt, there's also the simple fact that Egypt wasn't the only place to which this region was connected. There were people in the desert to the west. There were people in the desert to the east. There were people living along the African coast of the Red Sea and on the other side of the Red Sea in Arabia. There were people in the Ethiopian highlands to the southeast and in the tropical forests to the south. All of those diverse groups impacted what happened at places like Kerma. Influence is not a one-way street. When we look at what's now Sudan solely as an extension of Egypt, we miss all of that. We miss hunter-gatherers spreading out from the Nile into the ancient savannas of the Green Sahara. We're blind to the interplay between the trading kings of the Nubian A group and the first pharaohs. We can't see the development of a state that functioned much differently than the sacred monarchy of Egypt, but one that has no less to tell us about the basic fundamentals of how people develop and wield political power. The Middle Nile has a long history of its own. It's one buried in the fertile soil, deposited by the river's floods, and covered by wind-blown Saharan sands. It's not just something we can see vaguely reflected in the writings of the much more famous civilization to the north. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to head even further back to the north to meet the illiterate, but rich, sophisticated, and powerful princely societies of Bronze Age Europe. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.